Welcome to Gambling with an Edge with your hosts, Bob Dancer and Richard Munchkin. Bob Dancer is America's premier video poker writer and teacher. He's written 10 books, including Video Poker for the Intelligent Beginner and the best-selling Million Dollar Video Poker. He helped develop the computer software Video Poker for Winners, and in 2004, he was inducted into the Video Poker Hall of Fame. Richard Munchkin has been a professional Advantage player for over 30 years and is in the Blackjack Hall of Fame. His book, Gambling Wizards, Conversations with the World's Greatest Gamblers, is a testament to the many ways you can succeed at gambling. The goal of the show is that you'll be a more knowledgeable gambler tomorrow than you were yesterday. And now, here are Bob and Richard.
Good afternoon. Welcome to Gambling with an Edge. I'm Bob Dancer.
And I'm Richard Munchkin.
Our guest today is Zachary Elwood, author of two books on Poker Tells. Today we'll be speaking to Zach about his first book called Reading Poker Tells. We'll be speaking to Zach in a few minutes. There are 10 separate properties on the Las Vegas Strip that use the M Life Players Club, along with a few others around the country. They recently announced that beginning December 15th, players in the Las Vegas properties will no longer earn express comps while playing table games. What do you make of this, Richard?
It's just mind-boggling to me. I my first reaction was, have they forgotten how the gambling business works? I'm speechless, as you can tell. It just seems absolutely crazy to me. And be interesting, I think if a good operator came into Vegas and took over a strip casino and ran it well, I think they would just own all the business. I think they would just crush it, you know, because their competition is so out of touch.
It's easy to say bad things about Caesars. You're also saying bad things about Adelson. You're saying bad things about Wynn. And those are the major ones on the strip.
Yeah, yeah. I think if somebody came in, and we had Max on the show a few weeks ago, and he talked about, you know, the way Barona basically owns all the business in San Diego because they put in loose games and they're free with comps, and, you know, players get more time on the game, which is what players want. They're going to lose what they're going to lose, but if they can play at one casino and make their money last for 4 hours instead of 2 hours, then they're going to go play at the place that, you know, where their money lasts longer and where the casino gives them more, you know, in comps.
Very good. All right. The state of Nevada has declared daily fantasy sports to be gambling, and hence illegal in the state unless you get a license first. Nevada is a smallish state, population-wise, but influential with respect to what is and isn't gambling. It wouldn't surprise me if several other states followed suit. In addition, there have been lawsuits filed recently, and other state legislatures are taking up whether to allow daily fantasy sports. Just a few days ago, the New York Times published a lengthy expose of illegal gambling. Where is this ending up, Richard?
Boy, I said months ago that I wish there was a way I could bet the don't on daily fantasy sports. You know, I would like to bet that their stock would go down if they were publicly traded. This is all kind of happening really fast. It'll be interesting to see how it shakes out. As for Nevada, Ed Miller pointed out that if they have to be licensed in Nevada, presumably that means they could only pool the players from Nevada with other players from Nevada. And if that's true, there'd be no liquidity in the market. So, you know, they wouldn't bother entering the market. The other point that's come up on the internet a lot is that if they apply for these licenses, is that an admission that what they're doing is gambling, right? You know, if you need a gaming license from the state of Nevada, aren't you saying that it is gambling? And if so, that's sort of the opposite of their whole business model, is to claim that they're not gambling.
But it would also seem to be that the MGM or South Point or Stations could apply to get a license and form their own daily fantasy sports league in Nevada.
Yeah, that's true. But if you're already in Nevada and have the option of just making a bet in the sports book, would joining a daily fantasy be preferable, right? Because they're not going to be able to take people playing from California or whatever. It's going to have to be somebody physically in Nevada to make that bet.
Interesting case. They're currently daily, DraftKings is taking bets from players in Nevada as long as the address on their application was from another state. I find that curious. So presumably somebody in California could make bets if they had their address in Nevada. It's
They're not the sharpest tools in the drawer.
Yeah, I guess. All right, let's talk to our guest. Zach Elwood has been playing poker professionally or semi-professionally for about 10 years. He specialized in reading tells and has written a couple books about it. Zach Elwood, welcome to Gambling with an Edge.
Hi, guys. How's it going?
Good. Before somebody suggested you as a possible guest for this show, I had never heard of you, although admittedly poker isn't my game. Presumably, many of our listeners haven't either. So this is your chance to tell us who you are. Why should players look to you for good information about poker tells?
Sure. I guess I'll start with I started playing poker a good amount in college. This was back in like 2000 and took it pretty seriously, read a lot of books. Then I moved to Albuquerque, New Mexico in about 2003 and got into playing at the casino and playing higher stakes and played for a living for about 3 years. And then since then, just been playing on the side, more or less. And I had the idea for, you know, writing something about poker tells back in 2005, 2006, just because I felt like the books that were out there were not very good. You have Mike Caro's book, which is a classic. But I felt like I knew things that were not in the book. And I had, you know, I also talked to other experienced players who had played a lot. And I knew that there were things that people knew about that also weren't in the book and that nobody really talked about. So it wasn't that I felt like I was a genius at this stuff. It was more just a state of, you know, the fact that nobody had really written a really good book for a long time. And I felt like the stuff that was out there was kind of outdated and was mainly focused on very beginner level, you know, players and their tells. So that was kind of what led to it. And then, you know, but at the time it was during the poker boom. So I was always thinking like, well, somebody else who's more experienced is going to write, you know, eventually write this book, and beat me to it. So, you know, there's obviously there's plenty of good players out there who could do it. And then as more years went by and nobody wrote that book, I was like, oh, I might as well do it. So that's what led to it. It wasn't a, you know, kind of situation where I thought I was a genius or anything, because I definitely don't. It was more like recognizing that nobody was really tackling this in a way I thought was good and you know, educated and intelligent. So that's what led to writing the first book, and that came out in 2012, and I worked for about a couple years on that. And I had been keeping a blog too since 2010, writing about different hands and stuff. So yeah, that's kind of the short story.
And do you have a background? What is your background? Is it psychology, or was it just unrelated and this just happened to be a subject that you were drawn to?
Yeah, I mean, the background's not related at all. I had a video film degree, which I didn't really use much. Haven't really used much of it at all, honestly. And because I got into poker and was playing for a few years, and I'm kind of an armchair psychologist. Like I've always liked reading psychology books. When I was a kid, I used to read my dad's psychology books on his bookshelf. He had a bunch of, you know, academic books and psychology books, and I've always just liked thinking about psychology. So there was that tie-in, and plus I've been a writer too. Like I've written professionally, like done some copywriting and technical writing. So that it was kind of like a combination of my, you know, interests there too.
Now, beginning players have quite a few tells. As players become more experienced, surely they become better at hiding things. In a 20-40 no-limit hold'em game, for example, would you expect most of the players to be readable tell-wise, or most of them pretty inscrutable?
At 20-40, I've played a good amount of 20-40, and you still find a good amount of tells. I mean, it's a limit, so it's of useful. You know, you have to be really sure of a tell to act on it and limit, just because, you know, like for example, you know, the pot is so big in comparison to that last bet or whatever, you'd have to be really certain that somebody was comfortable to fold to them just because you're getting so, you know, such good odds, obviously. But, you know, there's little clues that come up in limit. You know, it's kind of like with all poker tells, it's more like these little clues you'll get occasionally, you know, like somebody lets their relaxation known, or, you know, tries to goad you into, you know, giving them action, or some little other thing, you know, crops up. It's not like you're reading a player in every hand. It's more like, you know, a few times a session, somebody might do something to sway you one way or another. And it's, and, you know, especially in limit, it's often the, you know, times when you're kind of on the fence about a decision anyway. And I think that's where a lot of the, you know, especially against experienced players, that's where a lot of your use comes from. You know, when you could go either way, you feel kind of like from a fundamental strategy perspective. So you kind of let a little bit of information sway you one way or another.
There was something early in your book where you were talking about some study and some tiny percentage of people that had some heightened ability to read other people. I forgot what you called them.
Oh, well, that was that's what Paul Ekman, who's a kind of famous behavioral analyst and theorist, he called them truth wizards. I was just quoting from a study that's kind of well known in the human behavior area, where they said that they claimed it's kind of a controversial claim, the more I've learned about it the last few years, but they claimed to say that some people were just naturally very good at reading the physical body language of other people and being able to say, you know, far and above most people whether someone was lying or not in these studies that they conducted. And that's Paul Ekman, who I don't know if you've heard of him, but they based his that show Lie to Me. I've never actually seen the show, but it's about a guy who was, you know, behavior analyst and you know, lie detector stuff, and they based a lot of that show on Paul Ekman's work.
I think there is a talent that, I mean, there are some people that are going to be much better at this than others. There's also a book by Daniel Goleman called Emotional Intelligence. I don't know if you've ever run across that, but...
No, I'll write that down. I'll check.
Yeah, and it's an area that is studied in psychology of a type of intelligence that are people that are able to understand what other people are thinking and feeling better than
right.
The rest of the people do.
Right.
And I think those people are going to be much better at picking up tells. But the problem that I always have when I sit down at a poker table is so few hands get shown down to the river that unless you're playing in a game with the same players all the time, it takes a really long time to gather any actual data about the people you're playing against.
Right. Yeah, it's, and there's definitely some, you know, some tells are more generally reliable than others. Like there's some tells that I would feel completely comfortable basing a decision on even without having seen past history of a player, but usually you want to, you know, the basic thing you want to do is usually you want to study a guy a little bit before you base a decision on something. But there's definitely some tells, like especially against players who aren't that good or experienced, there's some tells that are so generally reliable that you can feel good relying on them even in a general, you know, first time setting. But yeah, like what you say is correct. You know, you usually are trying to get a sense of what a player is like. You know, you want to see it a few times. And, you know, it can be tough because hands don't go to showdown, but a lot of times you get information, you know, like even if a guy folds on the river, like if he snap folds to a bet, you can be pretty sure that he was, you know, weak there. And maybe you saw, you know, if you saw him do something in that hand, then, you know, because usually most of the time people don't have hands either. That's the other thing. So a lot of times, you know, the way the hand goes down can give you information as to like, yeah, that guy was probably weak in drawing or, you know, things like that. But yeah, what you say is correct. I mean, it can be difficult to build up, you know, a good amount of sample size. And that's why it's, you know, it's not a magical thing. Like I say in the books, it's like, it's a small thing that will occasionally, you know, if you're dedicated and watching your opponents, it'll occasionally sway your decision and, you know, give you like a small, you know, small percentage increase in your win rate or something. But yeah, it's obviously nowhere near as important as strategy.
Can you talk about some of those things that are the ones that you just said would be things you would act on right away?
Sure. Generally, yeah. Well, one that is top of my mind just because I've been thinking about it more lately So I was doing all this footage analysis for these videos I was working on. I partnered with somebody who has some poker footage in Chicago of all these tournaments and home or tournaments and cash games that they run, and I was analyzing it, going through a lot of it. And one of the things I started looking at was players who double check their cards before making a big bet, you know, like post flop and after the flop and no limit hold'em. So I was studying specifically players who would double check their cards before making a significant bet, and that's, you know, almost entirely, like, you'll hardly ever find anybody doing that when they're bluffing, and it kind of makes sense when you think about it, right? Because double checking your cards before you bet could kind of be implied like, oh, I'm not sure what I have, I'm kind of uncertain about what I have. So a bluffer virtually never wants to, you know, do that. They don't want to accidentally convey that, you know, maybe there's some uncertainty about their hand or something. So it's a behavior you almost entirely see from people who are value betting, and it doesn't come up very often, right? And it's not something that happens that often. I see it, you know, once or twice a session or something, where somebody makes a, you know, double checks their hand on the river and then makes a you know, a big value bet. But it's, you know, those are one of the things. That's one example of a behavior that's really well correlated to somebody who's comfortable. And I'd feel, you know, I often feel comfortable basing a fold on that, you know, that alone. Just, you know, and I've seen it played out from specific players, and I can, you know, I feel comfortable that it shows up for, you know, so many people very, very usefully. So that's just one example. And, you know, I could give you a few more if you want.
Sure.
Yeah. So one of the major ones, and this is something that's, you know, much more likely for a, this is more well known. So you usually will only see it amongst, low stakes, you know, really inexperienced players, but it's a common one, at like 1-2 and limit games. The defensive kind of defensive chip handling or defensive hand motions, you know, like it's, and you guys have probably seen this if you played any poker at all, like where somebody's got a weak hand or a medium strength hand on the river on the last card, and they check, and as the other person's thinking, the person with the weak hand is, like, you know, acting like they're going to call, like putting some chips together or like reaching or maybe even just subtly reaching for their chips, you know. There's different forms of subtlety to it, but basically, yeah. almost always when somebody's reaching for their chips, when it's somebody else's turn to act, you know, it's a sign of defensiveness. It's a sign of, you know, I'm trying to insinuate that I might call this so you don't bet, you know, because I don't want to face a tough decision. So, you know, and of course they might call you, but the meaning is, you know, you can be quite certain, you know, their range has dropped a lot, you know, and you can be quite certain of that they're, you know, you're not going to get raised, and you're probably going to, you know, at least in no limit, you've got a good chance of getting a bluff through. But you had asked about 20-40 limit tells. That's one you see in limit, just because, you know, people aren't really thinking. You know, they're not nearly as cautious about their behavior. So you see it a lot even in 24 limit, because people just don't care. But and a lot of times they'll call you also because it's limit. But the interesting thing, like in 20-40, like if you're faced with a situation where you could, you know, you could potentially make a thin value bet, you know, like, you're gonna bet a medium strength hand that's you're not sure is good, and you might not want to bet. But if you see a guy acting defensively, you can make that then value bet and feel good that usually, you know, you're gonna be good there, like, you know, with just top pair or whatever the situation is, you know, with top pair with a medium strength kicker. Whereas you might not make that value bet if he wasn't acting so defensively.
If that tell is pretty well known, do you ever try to take advantage of it as a player? In other words, you do have the nuts, but you're making these defensive moves for the other guys to think, he's not very strong?
Right. I don't advocate false tells very much. I mean, I will do them occasionally, but it's a tricky area because it's not, you know, first you've got the problem of, you know, is your opponent actually going to see that information? And secondly, is he gonna know? You have to be confident that he's gonna give it the same meaning as you would give it, or as you would imagine he would give it. So, and that's not always really clear. Like, so that's why I say, you know, if you're gonna do a false tell, it basically has to be against strangers, because, you know, people you play against regularly are gonna, you know, have a sense of how you play, and, you know, you'll get you getting you might get one or two uses out of it, but, you know, probably not much more than that if they're at all observant, because they're, at the very least, they're just going to not trust your behavior. So first, it would have to be versus a stranger. And second, it would have to be somebody versus somebody who you perceive as being a thinking player who has experience reading that. And so you would be faking a behavior that is a well-known behavior. And he would have to think you were not a good player too. So if all those things combined, then it would be a good spot to, you know, give a false tell. But other than that, you know, especially for players who play against regulars and who, you know, if you're not sure what their level of thinking is, I just feel like most of the time, you know, trying to put out false tells is just really muddying the waters, because, you know, you might do something which you think is a really awesome false tell, and then the other guy just makes him suspicious and he calls, whereas, you know, somebody else, it would have told him the opposite information, you know. So, but I think if all those things combine and the stars align, then it's a good spot to give a false tell and give it a shot. But it's not something I generally, you know, advocate.
In the past, you've consulted with people in the November 9 finals of the World Series of Poker. Are you doing that for this year with anybody?
Yeah, I am. I am doing it with one of the players this year. Yeah.
And can you talk about what your process? I mean, is the player more worried about just making sure he isn't revealing anything, or are you analyzing all the other players to try to see if you can find anything that he can take advantage of?
Yeah, it's kind of all of it. It's just watching any footage that's available for not just from this year's footage, because some of the players have footage from other events they've been in. So it's analyzing any available footage, and then you know, basically it's just comparing spots, you know, seeing if you can see if I can find anything interesting that's, you know, behavioral, you know, difference between different situations. So it's both. I'm analyzing his footage and all the other available footage of all the opponents and looking for anything I can find.
And how do you go about getting the footage?
Oh, well, some of the other players have been in other events that were put online, you know.
So they're on YouTube or something, or?
Yeah, some of them are on YouTube. I'd say, yeah, all of them. There were only a couple that were not on YouTube. Yeah, so it's just a research, and it's not like a whole lot of video, because it's, you know, it's like a few events worth of you know, where some of the players were in. But yeah, the interesting thing about the World Series of Poker final table is, you know, it's got so many experienced players in it, and a lot of them have played other big events and some televised events. But it's all, obviously it's a challenge, because all those players are very experienced. You know, usually they're very experienced. It's pretty rare these days to get somebody who's not experienced at the final table.
But the final table is going to start in 2 weeks, and in right now on ESPN, you're starting to see the events from this year building up, and they haven't been televised until just very recently. So,
right.
So would that be your work, is like going into overload now as you watch all of these things, looking for to predict the other November Niners?
Right. Yeah, you're exactly right. Yeah, they're all just being released now every week. So it's, you know, ideally, I would love to have that footage a little bit earlier, but got to
work with what you got.
Yeah.
When you've done this for anybody in the past, has it ever led to like an actual wow, here is where the money was moment, where the person that you were coaching actually was able to take advantage of a specific thing that you found in the footage and was
no,
able to tell them?
No, I've only done it once before. This was 2 years ago. And, you know, it's such a long shot for the information to come into play, just because there are so few hands played when you get down to it. And, you know, not to mention that neither of, you know, when I work for somebody like that, I mean, we're both aware that it's a pretty long shot that I would find something that would be very useful, and second, that it would actually come into play, just because there's so many, you know, a lot of the action happens pre-flop in the game, and there's just honestly, it's such a small part of the of playing poker in the first place.
Sure.
And you know, the guy I worked for in 2013, Amir Lahavit, who ended up getting third, he put it really well. It was like, it's more like just covering your bases. It's like, in case there is something there, I would like to have people looking for it, right? And I will say, in 2011, when I analyzed footage, I was just doing it on my own. I analyzed the final table, and I found a really very reliable poker tell on the guy who won that year. It was P.S. Hines, and it's like one of the most reliable, and also a good sample size, because he played for a while, you know, heads up, one on one with the other player. So, and I actually made a video about it. So if you search for P.S. Hines poker tell, WSOP or something, you'll find it. And he had a very reliable poker tell. So it's that kind of thing where, like, you know, if I found something even close to that reliable for a player, it'd be great, right?
Well, I'm surprised you put it on a video rather than tried to find someone to go play against him.
Oh, no. I mean, he probably, I have a feeling like he figured it out. That's the other thing too. Like, people change, right? So, and I'm sure, like, after that, I'm sure he had friends, you know, because he had experience, poker friends, and I'm sure, like, I wasn't the only one who noticed it amongst, you know, experienced poker players. And, you know, it's not like I wouldn't go out of my way to take advantage of that anyway. I mean, maybe if it was me personally playing, then I would, but I'm not going to tell anybody else. I'd rather make it public, and then he can benefit from it too, right?
Yeah. But now, do you also go to the final table, and are you one of the guys sitting there in the stands and
yelling and screaming and making a fool of yourself?
No, not that part, but actually watching the game as it happens and you know, talking to your player about what you're observing.
No, we found that it made more sense for me to be watching on the delay, and that way I could see close up stuff and just send my thoughts to them via Skype. But it would be nice to see it live, but I would have a hard time, you know, seeing what I wanted to see. And
you can't rewind live.
Right, that too. Yeah, that's the other thing. Like, if I wanted to watch something over again on a break, or, you know, real quickly right there, yeah, I want to have it, like, easily recording and easily available.
Yeah.
But, you know, there are weaknesses to watching stuff, you know, in televised coverage, because one of the big weaknesses is, you know, when somebody makes a bet, the usual television production format is to cut away from the person who just made the bet and watch the other player, whereas I would much prefer to watch the player who just made the bet.
You know, I remember a long time ago saying it would be worth a lot of money if you could have all of the feeds. If you could just record, like, all of the cameras and have that as a database, that'd be worth a lot of money to somebody.
But, yeah, I mean,
but
I would.
You'd have to be able to sort it. That's...
Yeah, have it nice and organized. Yeah.
Yeah, but I mean, in editing, we do that all the time. We have hundreds of hours of footage, and, you know,
we
sort it.
Yeah, I would love that. You know, I'm sure whoever was, you know, if I, like, the guy I'm working for, like, who's playing for that much money, those guys would all love to have that ability to surf through that footage, you know, and it would be I would love it, because that's one of the main things that gets in the way of analyzing televised footage, is they're always cutting away from the player who just acted, you know, which is not ideal for me.
Well, good. Once you buy ESPN, then you can just save a copy. Okay.
Yeah.
Now,
I don't know. You could make friends with somebody who's an editor there, and who knows what you could get your hands on.
I might have tried that.
Now, is there a difference between reading tells in tournaments as opposed to online, or online or online? Oh. There's not a lot of them, or brick and mortar
cash games.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, tournaments, I've always said it's a lot easier to find tells in cash games than it is in tournaments, just because tournaments, you know, people are so much more intense in the first place. Like, even if you go play, like, a small stakes tournament at your local card room, the players are just so much more kind of focused and stoic than they are in the similar staked cash games, you know. And it's because I think part of it is, you know, it's an all or nothing thing. Like, people take it seriously, that they don't want to get knocked out. And it's also, they're emulating what they see on TV when everybody's taking a while to act and they're all serious and stoic, you know. I think that's part of it, too. It's all these things that make the tournament more intense and the people are more self-aware. And also another thing is the tournament rules about, you know, verbal stuff. People are afraid to talk during a tournament, whereas at a cash game, people are much more loose and talking and stuff like that. So it's all those factors that make cash games much more easier to get reads in.
I just want to say the most ridiculous game that I ever saw in terms of reading tells was I was on a cruise ship and they had one of those electronic tables where the cards are all electronic and you cup
right.
your hands on the glass and it shows you what your cards are.
Uh-huh.
And it seemed like all the people felt like they were playing a slot machine or something, so they had no regard at all to
what they were doing,
to
right.
trying to hide the way they felt. You know, they would look at their cards and make faces, and it was really just ridiculous, although unfortunately the stakes were very low. But
that's interesting, though. Yeah, I played one of those tables in where was it? It was in Cabo, I think. It was in Cabo. Yeah, and they had one of those machines. And you're right, everybody was just really... It was only like 1-2 or something. It was, something like that. But everybody was really kind of distanced from the idea that they were playing against other people in the room. Yeah, that's an interesting phenomenon.
If we get any positive feedback at all concerning this podcast, which strikes me as very likely, we're going to invite you back sometime in the future to talk about your second book, which is called Verbal Poker Tells. On your website, readingpokertells.com, you offer 5 free daily emails on this subject. How are these free emails different from what's in the book?
Well, they're basically edited portions of the book. I mean, the book's pretty long, honestly. It's probably a little bit longer than it needs to be, but I wanted to include a lot of stuff. So the emails are basically it really was my attempt to pack like as much as I could of like the top 5 patterns that I picked out that I think were like the most important and practical clues you can get at the poker table. So, I mean, I actually think the email course just by itself is really valuable in my opinion. And, you know, if people like it, then I'd say, you know, get the book. But I think people will get a lot out of just the course.
I just want to mention that I will, on my site, there'll be links to your website and the book. And you also host a forum at 2+2 about tells, so which seems to be quite popular as well. So there's a lot of information out there that...
Yeah, they just started that one. That was we just started that a few weeks ago. I was honored that they approached me about it, and I was like, that sounds cool. And yeah, that just got off the ground, and I'm encouraging people to like leave questions in their like hands that they've played in there, and I think it's getting interesting. Yeah, there's some good questions in there. I thought there were some interesting threads.
How much is tell reading an inborn characteristic, and how much of it is learned?
Well, like we were saying, you know, I do think that there are people that are just inherently better at it to start with, and I would say, like, I was not one of those people. Like, I think that's one of the reasons I've always been interested in it, because I liked trying to come at it from a scientific approach and say, like, you know, in these situations, in this specific situation, what's more like, what is this likely to mean, you know, And trying to study that specific situation. So I think it is inborn, you know, to an extent. I think there are people that are natural at it, but I also believe you can get better at it by work, you know, because I'm a perfect example. Like I think I've improved so much just in the, you know, not just in playing for one thing, and then over the past few years and working on these books and watching a lot of video. Like I feel like I've gotten better just in the past year, like making these videos that I've been working on. It's just you know, even though I, you know, even just a few years ago, I would have said like, oh, I'm probably at the top of my ability tell reading wise, or near the top, you know. I wasn't confident there was much more to go. But then, you know, in the last couple of years, I feel like I learned more things, and I was like, oh, well, maybe, you know, maybe it keeps going much farther than I know, you know.
On your website, readingpokertells.com. There's a place where you analyze Scott Seaver's chatter during last year's $1 million one-drop tournament. We have about 5 minutes. Can you share some of that with us?
Yeah, one second. Let me, I'm trying to bring up that blog post. Sorry. I should have had that up. Scott Seaver's verbal behavior in one drop. Yeah, I wouldn't say I have a, you know, I talked about this hand just because people were talking about it, and it wasn't like I don't think I can read Scott Seaver. I think he's a very experienced player. But I did think, it was worth talking about because I felt like there were some things that, kind of fit some general patterns I talked about. But, you know, don't get me wrong. I mean, I would not want to play Scott Seaver. So what did I say here? He said, so the hand plays out. Do you guys remember offhand how the hand plays out, or do you want me to go into that at all?
Well, I just looked at it yesterday in preparing these notes, so I have a good idea of it. I'm sure many of our readers have no idea what I'm talking about.
So, sorry, I'm reading the blog post. It doesn't go into
that. It basically had to do with he had a king 10, and he got his opponent to fold a pair of aces, and the opponent had no idea. And the opponent had him crushed.
Oh, that's right. He was bluffing on the turn.
Sort of. If he drew a club, he would have had a flush. And he had some outs. So it was maybe a 20 or 30% chance. But he went all in. And after 10 minutes, Dan Negreanu called the clock. And so his opponent tanked. And but Seaver was talking to him, and then when the guy said he had a pair of aces, Seaver kind of shut up.
Okay, yeah. So this is what the pattern was. It was, it fit this pattern that I talked about in the book, where a bluffer will usually want to imply that his opponent has a strong hand because it makes him seem more comfortable with his opponent having a strong hand. So in this example, when Seaver said a lot of things before his opponent folded the aces, but one of the things he said was, everyone knows what you have anyway. You either have ace king or king queen, and there was a queen on the board, I think, for top pair. So he was implying that his opponent was thinking about folding or calling with a strong hand, and that part kind of fit the pattern I talk about in verbal poker tells, where a bluffer has an incentive to imply, you know, or state that his opponent has a strong hand, because doing that implies indirectly that he's comfortable with.
Yeah, Seaver could not have beaten what he said the guy had.
Yeah, he couldn't have beat that. Yeah, he couldn't have beat that hand, and he was basically saying, like, I know you've got a tough decision. You've got a strong hand, and this is kind of the opposite of, like, you'll. This is a more common behavior when somebody's betting. Say Seaver was betting a strong hand, a common thing you hear someone say when they have a strong hand and their opponent's thinking, their opponent might say something like, well, you know what I have, and the person betting the strong hand would say something like, I have no idea what you have. He's basically saying, like, you could have a really weak hand, you could have a really strong hand, you know, you might be weak, whereas somebody who's bluffing has more incentive to be like, I know you've got a strong hand here, you know. And it's actually funny because Seaver, there was another hand, I'm not sure if I put it in the blog post, actually, but I remember it. It was from Poker After Dark, I think, that show. Or maybe High Stakes Poker, where Seaver, Seaver had made a bet and somebody else, and Seaver had a strong hand, and Seaver said, I have no idea what you have. And it was like the exact opposite information. I'm not sure if I put that in the blog post now that I think about it.
It was very same hand in the one drop. Seaver started out saying that, and then he changed his tune in a few minutes.
Oh, he said that he didn't know what he had?
Yeah, that was his first comment in the one drop on this
particular hand. Oh, in that same
hand? Yeah.
Oh, okay. I'll have to check that out. But the hand I was talking about was like a cash game. But anyway, like I said, I would not, because Seaver's so experienced, it's not like I would feel confident basing something on that because he is so experienced. But the blog post was about, you know, It's showing how these patterns can show up from more recreational players, where you'd be much more confident basing a decision on something like that.
All right. Thank you, Zach. We've been talking to Zach Elwood, author of the book on Reading Poker Tells. His website is readingpokertells.com. Wouldn't surprise me if you hear him on this show again in the not-too-distant future. Thank you, Zach.
Hey, thank you guys for the opportunity.
The South Point has more than 10,000 games returning more than 99%. That's more than anybody else has. The promotion in October is called Swipe, Spin, and Win. Play 300 points each day between Sunday and Wednesday and spin the virtual wheel. Prizes range from 2,500 points, which is worth $7.50, to $50 in free play. I have gotten all those gifts along the way, so it is pretty random what your... what your mailer is going in has nothing to do with it. It's a good low roller tournament if you live close to the South Point. Free video poker class tomorrow, Wednesday, is Bonus Poker Deluxe. This is like Jack's or Better, except you get more for four of a kind and only half as much for two pair. The strategy is very similar to Jack's or Better, but the two-pair getting single money instead of double money changes a lot of the plays, especially with regards to holding inside straights. So we'll talk about that tomorrow at noon. At the Palms, every Friday's a drawing. 10 people earn a total of $10,000 with the largest prize of $3,000. Don't have to be there. But you do need to claim before midnight. They have multiple points Friday afternoon and Friday evening. Saturday evenings, there's two more this month. They get double points. So that's an extra 0.25% on video poker between 7 and 10 p.m. They have play for prizes. And right now we have May Company gift cards. So you earn it at a rate of 0.2%. The prizes must be earned and redeemed Monday through Friday. So the double points that you're earning do not count towards those gift cards. At videopoker.com, it's the best place to play a lot of games. If you sign up for the gold membership, $8.95 a month or $79.95 a year, this allows you to get corrections on most of the games. It's a good place to practice quick quads, for example. You can get the strategy from me or from Shaq's website, but if you want a correction, go to videopoker.com. This week's weekly contest is Ultimate Four of a Kind. This contest is in the five-play version. This is a six-coin per line game where you get paid as though it was five coins, but four of a kinds get bigger prizes. Plus, when you get four of a kind, you go to a bonus round where you pick between one or four prizes on the board. It averages about 300 coins for one pick up to, if you get three picks, it's about 900. So if you get dealt aces or something, you're going to get four picks for the aces times five if you're on five plays. That's quite a few picks, and you'll get quite a bit. So you can dream about being dealt aces, but of course people dream about that in a lot of different video poker games. All right.
And other games as well, even not at video poker. You dream about getting aces.
Yes, I'm sure. If you know you're getting an ace, it's what, 50% advantage at blackjack or something like that?
Yeah, yeah.
All right, so what did you learn out of the Zach Elwood, the studying of it? I'm not real good at reading poker. I'm not good at very much in poker.
Yeah, but, you know, I don't play a lot of poker, and I find he makes a point in the book that some people, like Dan Harrington being one of them, say, you know, that it's really hard, and I agree, but that's not really an excuse. I mean, if you're a full-time poker player, it's supposed to be work. You know, you're supposed to work hard. So, but I do find it hard if I sit down at a game in a casino where I know nobody at the table to keep my focus. You know what I mean? Because, as I said, it takes so long before a hand is actually played all the way to the end, you know. And then by the time it is, you think, oh, I should have been watching that guy, you know.
Plus, you have to have a pretty strong memory there. Even if you're a regular player at a game, there might be 20, 30, 40 players who are more or less regular players in the game, too, that you see sort of all the time, but it's a different group of these 40 or 50 every night.
Yeah.
And so that is like, well, was he the guy who did it this way, or was he the guy who did it that way?
Yeah. Well, if I were taking it seriously, I would make notes. You know, you can always stand up from the table with your phone and make notes about players, but I just don't play much poker, so.
You would actually make notes on your phone while you were in the room?
Absolutely. Oh, yeah. Yeah. I mean, I do that in casinos all the time about you know, table games and stuff. So I would do the same thing in poker, sure.
Oh, good. I had never... I play pretty much low limit. Can almost hold my own at Omaha 8, which is a high-low split game played for low stakes. And it's done purely for recreation and fun. But I'm not seeing anybody in the poker room with a cell phone taking notes. Now, I don't know what they do when they go to the men's room, but...
Don't you see people stand up from the table to text all the time? I mean, I certainly do when I play poker. People, you know, you'll start to text and the dealer will go, you got to get up from the table. And then they stand up and they send their text and then they sit back down. Well, I would just do that.
Okay, so you let the dealer tell you.
Yeah.
Yeah, one of the things, we actually got him off the air too early. The commercials didn't take as long as I thought they were going to. We had a lot of other questions for him. One of the things that we have to ask him next time is the difference between men and women reading tells. Now, women tend to be more sensitive to other people's emotions and empathetic and those kind of things. So I would think that would make them better students of tells than men. I'd like to know if that's his conclusion as well.
Yeah, I, like you, that would be my gut reaction, is that they're probably better, but yeah, I have no idea. I don't play with many women. I mean, when you go to the casinos, it's mostly men playing, so.
Very good. He also indicated that he thought tells were such a small percent and mainly its fundamentals. I would have liked to put a number on it.
I've seen other players put a number of 10% on tells. I don't even know if it's that high. But, I mean, I think they're also including things like you notice that a player always raises from the cutoff if nobody is raised or that kind of thing. You know, I think if you include that kind of stuff, you know, or this player will fold his blind if you raise, you know. I wouldn't really call that tells, but maybe you put that into the same category. I mean, so, I don't know. 10% is a number I've heard thrown around. Maybe that came from Mike Caro. I don't know. But.
So, yeah, like I've seen it on television where I'll be watching Daniel Negreanu, or sometimes he'll say across the table, I think you have a pair of queens or a pair of kings. You know, and not always, of course, but he's right a significant percentage of the time, far more than just a wild-ass guess.
The one who's spooky is Phil Ivey.
Phil Ivey is good at that.
Yeah. Yeah, where he'll just call somebody with a complete bluff where he doesn't really have much better than the bluff, you know.
But so you're wondering how much of the insight comes from the actual tells or from the context of the way the hand's been played so far. Because now I don't know that that's what you'd call a tell or not. But,
right.
Well, he raised on here and he didn't raise here, but he looked a little bit funny. And we had Phil Ivey apparently is back in the news on his case against the Borgata. They're suing him to get him to pay back $9 million or something that he and Chung Lee, is that her name, took playing Borgata. And Phil Ivey's suing and said, hey, you threw away the cards that we were using while we were playing, and so that jeopardizes our case, so we think we're going to sue you for that. And so the Borgata hates to, now they're objecting to his countersuit.
Right, right. And he's also appealing the case in London, which, I mean, there was some question whether that was going to happen, but that they are appealing it, so that is going forward. So hopefully he'll win both those cases. And
yeah, not so much like he needs the money. We're not worried so much about that. It's the players...
The precedent.
have a leg to stand on when they go up against casinos.
Yeah.
The more rulings that go against players on these, we'll call them 50-50 calls, then the worse it is going to be for people in our business.
Yeah, we also had that case of Casey in London who they just came out and said, our rules prohibit card counting and you guys were counting cards, and they stole $40,000 from him. I want to get him on the show because of that movie that people ask me about constantly called Inside the Edge, which he keeps telling me is almost done. I've been hearing that for 3 years, I think. So anyway, I'm trying to get a hold of him to get him on the show along with Chris, the guy he made the movie with, because I think it really is almost done. So hopefully we'll get an update on what's going on with that case as well. So,
all right. If somebody wanted to get a copy of some of our old shows, how would they do it?
Well, first of all, we welcome your questions, and you can send them to us at gamblingwithanedge@gmail.com or our Facebook page, facebook.com/gamblingwithanedge, or you can tweet them at me at RWM21. You can sign up to get the show delivered to you every week automatically at iTunes, Stitcher, YouTube, or my site, richardmunchkin.com. And to hear, to see an archive of all of the old shows, every show, even the ones I wasn't on, you can find those at bobdancer.com.
Very good. Thank you, Richard. Thank you, Zach Elwood. Goodbye, everybody. Go out and hit lots of royal flushes.
You've been listening to Gambling with an Edge with your hosts, Bob Dancer and Richard Munchkin. Subscribe to the show in iTunes, and episodes will be delivered to you automatically every week. Archived versions of past shows may be found at bobdancer.com and richardmunchkin.com. We welcome emails at gamblingwithanedge@gmail.com. Bob Dancer and Richard Munchkin are both available on Facebook and welcome your questions. The sponsors for the show are the South Point Hotel, Casino, and Spa, the M Resort, the Palms Casino Resort, and the website videopoker.com. Join us again next week for another Gambling with an Edge.